This is Audible.
Reminiscences of a Stock Operator by Edwin Lefebvre. This report they would show to any doubting Thomas who was impolite enough to speak about bucketing customers' orders. They did not spare anyone, women, schoolteachers, and old men being their best bet. "I'm sore on all brokers," I told the tout. "I'll have to think this over." And I left him, so he wouldn't talk any more to me. I inquired about this firm. I learned that they had hundreds of customers, and although there were the usual stories, I did not find any case of a customer not getting his money from them if he won any. I heard nothing alarming about the tout's firm, except that they were on the make first, last, and all the time, and that they were not always truthful. Their specialty was trimming suckers who wanted to get rich quick. Well, I admit frankly that I wasn't concerned with the business ethics of the firm. I did not propose to let them do any trading for me or follow their tips or believe their lies. My one concern was with getting together a stake and returning to New York. Anyhow, I made up my mind that I would see what trading advantages of this firm offered over what you might call the legitimate brokers. I went down to their place and had a talk with the manager himself. When he found out that I was an old trader and had formerly had accounts in New York with stock exchange houses, and that I had lost all I took with me, he stopped promising to make $1 million a minute for me if I let them invest my savings. He figured that I was a permanent sucker, the ticker hound kind that always plays and always loses, a steady income provider for brokers, whether they were the kind that bucket your orders or modestly content themselves with the commissions. I just told the manager that what I was looking for was decent execution, because I always traded at the market, and I didn't want to get reports that showed a difference of a half or a whole point from the ticker price. He assured me on his word of honor that they would do whatever I thought was right. If I opened an account with them, I could buy and sell at the price which came over the wire. They were so confident of their brokers. Naturally, that meant that I could trade there to all intents and purposes as though I were in a bucket shop. That is, they'd let me trade at the next quotation. I didn't want to appear too anxious, so I shook my head and told him I guessed I wouldn't open an account that day, but I'd let him know. I had given him my name and address, and that very same day I began to get prepaid telegrams and letters urging me to get aboard of some stock or other in which they said they knew an inside pool was operating for a 50-point rise. I was busy going around and finding out all I could about several other brokerage concerns of the same bucketing kind. It seemed to me that if I could be sure of getting my winnings out of their clutches, the only way of my getting together some real money was to trade in these near bucket shops. When I had learned all I could, I opened accounts with three firms. I had taken a small office and had direct wires run to the three brokers. I traded in a small way so they wouldn't get frightened off at the very start. I also established a connection with a local firm that had a direct wire to its New York correspondent, who were also members of the New York Stock Exchange. I had a stock ticker put in, and I began to trade conservatively. It was pretty much like trading in bucket shops, only it was a little slower. It was a game that I could beat, and I did. I never got it down to such a fine point that I could win 10 times out of 10, but I won on balance, taking it week in and week out. I was again living pretty well, but always saving something, to increase the stake that I was to take back to Wall Street. I got a couple of wires into 2 more of these bucketing brokerage houses, making 5 in all, and of course, my good firm. There were times when my plans went wrong, and my stocks did not run true to form, but did the opposite of what they should have done if they had kept up their regard for precedent. But they did not hit me very hard. They couldn't, with my shoestring margins. My relations with my brokers were friendly enough. Their accounts and records did not always agree with mine, and the differences uniformly happened to be against me. Curious coincidence not. But I fought for my own and usually had my way in the end. They always had the hope of getting away from me what I had taken from them. They regarded my winnings as temporary loans, I think. Several times they tried to double-cross me with old tricks. They caught me a couple of times because I wasn't looking. They always did that when I had taken no more than my usual line. I accused them of being short sports or worse, but they denied it, and it ended by my going back to trading as usual. The beauty of doing business with a crook is that he always forgives you for catching him, so long as you don't stop doing business with him. It's all right as far as he's concerned. He's willing to meet you more than halfway. Magnanimous souls. Well, I made up my mind that I couldn't afford to have the normal rate of increase of my stake impaired by crook's tricks, so I decided to teach them a lesson. I picked out some stock that, after having been a speculative favorite, had become inactive, waterlogged. If I had taken one that had never been active, they would have suspected my play. I gave out buying orders on this stock to my 5 bucketeering brokers. When the orders were taken and they were waiting for the next quotation to come out on the tape, I sent in an order through my stock exchange house to sell 100 shares of that particular stock at the market. I urgently asked for quick action. Well, you can imagine what happened when the selling order got to the floor of the exchange. A dull, inactive stock that a commission house with out-of-town connections wanted to sell in a hurry. Somebody got cheap stock, but the transaction as it would be printed on the tape was the price that I would pay on my 5 buying orders. I was long on balance, 400 shares of that stock at a low figure. The wirehouse asked me what I'd heard, and I said I had a tip on it. Just before the close of the market, I sent an order to my reputable house to buy back that 100 shares and not waste any time, that I didn't want to be short under any circumstances, and I didn't care what they paid. So they wired to New York, and the order to buy that 100 quick resulted in a sharp advance. I, of course, had put in selling orders for the 500 shares that my friends had bucketed. It worked very satisfactorily. One day the stunt worked so well that it went far beyond all calculations for a 10-point swing. I wasn't looking for it. As a matter of fact, it so happened that I had 200 shares instead of my usual 100 at one broker's, though only 100 in the 4 other shops. That was too much of a good thing for them. So they were sore as pups about it, and they began to say things over the wires. So I went and saw the manager, the same man who had been so anxious to get my account and so forgiving every time I caught him trying to put something over on me. He talked pretty big for a man in his position. "That was a fictitious market for that stock, and we won't pay you a damned cent," he swore. "It wasn't a fictitious market when you accepted my order to buy. You let me in then, all right, and now you've got to let me out. You can't get around that for fairness, can you?" "Yes, I can," he yelled. "I can prove that somebody put up a job."
"Who put up a job?" I asked.
"Somebody."
"Who did they put it up on?" I asked.
"Some friends of yours were in it as sure as pop," he said.
But I told him, "You know very well that I play a lone hand. Everybody in this town knows that. They've known it ever since I started trading in stocks. Now, I want to give you some friendly advice. You just send and get that money for me. I don't want to be disagreeable. Just do what I tell you."
"I won't pay. It was a rigged-up transaction," he yelled.
"You'll pay it to me right now and here." He blustered a little more and accused me flatly of being the guilty thimble rigger. But he finally forked over the cash. The others were not so rambunctious. I got my money from all, but that 10-point jump put an end to the pleasing pastime of skinning skinners. They were on the lookout for the little trick that they themselves had used to defraud hundreds of poor customers. I went back to my regular trading, but the market wasn't always right for my system, that is, limited as I was by the size of the orders they would take. I couldn't make a killing. I had been at it over a year, during which I used every device that I could think of to make money trading in those wirehouses. I had saved up a fair-sized roll, and there wasn't so much money to be made in the 5 wirehouses, so I decided to return to New York. After I got back to New York to try for the 3rd time to beat the market in a stock exchange house I traded quite actively, I didn't expect to do as well as I did in the bucket shops. But I thought that after a while I would do much better, because I would be able to swing a much heavier line.
Yet I can see now that my main trouble was my failure to grasp the vital difference between stock gambling and stock speculation. Still, by reason of my 7 years' experience in reading the tape and a certain natural aptitude for the game, my stake was earning not indeed a fortune, but a very high rate of interest. I won and lost as before, but I was winning on balance. The first change I made in my play was in the matter of time. I couldn't wait for the sure thing to come along and then take a point or two out of it as I could in the bucket shops. I had to start much earlier if I wanted to catch the move in Fullerton's office. In other words, I had to study what was going to happen, to anticipate stock movements. I had to go further back than an hour in my studies of the market, which was something I never would have learned to do in the biggest bucket shop in the world. I interested myself in trade reports and railroad earnings and financial and commercial statistics. Of course, I loved to trade heavily, and they called me the boy plunger, but I also liked to study the moves. I never thought that anything was irksome if it helped me to trade more intelligently. Before I can solve a problem, I must state it to myself. When I think I have found the solution, I must prove I am right. I know of only one way to prove it, and that is with my own money. Studying my winning plays in Fullerton's office, I discovered that although I often was 100% right on the market, that is, in my diagnosis of conditions and general trend, I was not making as much money as my market rightness entitled me to. Why wasn't I? There was as much to learn from partial victory as from defeat. For instance, I'd been bullish from the very start of a bull market, and I had backed my opinion by buying stocks. An advance followed, as I had clearly foreseen. So far, all very well. But what else did I do? Why, I listened to the elder statesman and curbed my youthful impetuousness. I made up my mind to be wise and play carefully, conservatively. Everybody knew that the way to do that was to take profits and buy back your stocks on reactions. And that is precisely what I did, or rather what I tried to do. For I often took profits and waited for a reaction that never came. And I saw my stock go kiting up 10 points more, and I sitting there with my 4-point profit safe in my conservative pocket. They say you never grow poor taking profits. No, you don't. But neither do you grow rich taking a 4-point profit in a bull market. Where I should have made $20,000, I made $2,000. That was what my conservatism did for me. I knew I needed to change my bucket shop methods, and I thought I was solving my problem with any change, particularly one that assayed high gold values according to the experienced traders among the customers. Most, let us call them customers, are alike. You find very few who can truthfully say that Wall Street doesn't owe them money. In Fullerton's, there were the usual crowd. Well, there was one old chap who was not like the others. To begin with, he was a much older man. Another thing was that he never volunteered advice and never bragged of his winnings. His name was Partridge, but they nicknamed him Turkey behind his back because he was so thick-chested and had a habit of strutting about the various rooms with the point of his chin resting on his breast. The customers, who were all eager to be shoved and forced into doing things so as to lay the blame for failure on others, used to go to old Partridge and tell him what some friend of an insider had advised them to do in a certain stock. They would tell him what they had not done with the tip, so he would tell them what they ought to do. But whether the tip they had was to buy or to sell, the old chap's answer was always the same. The customer would finish the tale of his perplexity and then ask, "What do you think I ought to do?" The old turkey would cock his head to one side, contemplate his fellow customer with a fatherly smile, and finally he would say, very impressively,
"You know, it's a bull market."
Time and again I heard him say,
"Well, this is a bull market, you know."
As though he were giving you a priceless talisman wrapped up in a $1 million accident insurance policy, and of course I did not get his meaning. One day a fellow named Elmer Harwood rushed into the office, wrote out an order, and gave it to the clerk. Then he rushed over to Mr. Partridge. "Mr. Partridge, I have just sold my Climax Motors. My people say the market is entitled to a reaction and that I'll be able to buy it back cheaper, so you'd better do likewise, that is, if you've still got yours." Elmer looked suspiciously at the man to whom he'd given the original tip to buy.
"Yes, Mr. Harwood, I still have it." "Of course," said Turkey gratefully. It was nice of Elmer to think of the old chap.
"Well, now is the time to take your profit and get in again on the next dip," said Elmer. "I have just sold every share I owned."
But Mr. Partridge shook his head regretfully and whined,
"No, no, I can't do that."
"What?" yelled Elmer.
"I simply can't," said Mr. Partridge. He was in great trouble.
"Didn't I give you the tip to buy it?"
"You did, Mr. Harwood, and I am very grateful to you. Indeed, I am, sir, but—"
"Hold on. Let me talk. And didn't that stock go up 7 points in 10 days, didn't it?"
"It did, and I am much obliged to you, my dear boy. But I couldn't think of selling that stock."
"You couldn't?"
"No, I couldn't."
"Why not?"
And Elmer drew nearer.
"Why, this is a bull market." The old fellow said it as though he'd given a long and detailed explanation.
"I know this is a bull market as well as you do, but you'd better slip them that stock of yours and buy it back on the reaction. You might as well reduce the cost to yourself."
"My dear boy," said old Partridge in great distress. "My dear boy, if I sold that stock now, I'd lose my position. And then where would I be?"
Elmer Harwood threw up his hands, shook his head, and walked over to me to get sympathy. "Can you beat it? I give him a tip on Climax Motors. He buys 500 shares. He's got 7 points profit, and I advise him to get out and buy 'em back on the reaction that's overdue even now. And what does he say when I tell him? He says that if he sells, he'll lose his job. What do you know about that?"
"I beg your pardon, Mr. Harwood. I didn't say I'd lose my job," cut in old Turkey. "I said I'd lose my position. And when you are as old as I am, and you've been through as many booms and panics as I have, you'll know that to lose your position is something nobody can afford, not even John D. Rockefeller. I hope the stock reacts, and that you will be able to repurchase your line at a substantial concession, sir. But I, myself, can only trade in accordance with the experience of many years. I paid a high price for it, and I don't feel like throwing away a second tuition fee. But I am as much obliged to you as if I had the money in the bank. It's a bull market, you know."
And he strutted away, leaving Elmer dazed. What old Partridge said did not mean much to me until I began to think about my own numerous failures to make as much money as I ought to when I was so right on the general market. The more I studied, the more I realized how wise that old chap was. He had evidently suffered the same defect in his young days and knew his own human weaknesses. He would not lay himself open to a temptation that experience had taught him was hard to resist and had always proved expensive to him, as it was to me. I think it was a long step forward in my trading education when I realized at last that when old Mr. Partridge kept on telling the other customers, "Well, you know this is a bull market," he really meant to tell them that the big money was not in the individual fluctuations, but in the main movements, that is, not in reading the tape, but in sizing up the entire market and its trend. And right here let me say one thing. After spending many years in Wall Street, and after making and losing millions of dollars, I want to tell you this. It never was my thinking that made the big money for me. It was my sitting. Got that? My sitting tight. It is no trick at all to be right on the market. You always find lots of early bulls in bull markets and early bears in bear markets. I've known many men who were right at exactly the right time and began buying or selling stocks when prices were at the very level which should show the greatest profit, and their experience invariably matched mine. That is, They made no real money out of it. Men who can both be right and sit tight are uncommon. I found it one of the hardest things to learn. But it is only after a stock operator has firmly grasped this that he can make big money. In the spring of 1906, I was in Atlantic City for a short vacation. I was out of stocks and was thinking only of having a change of air and a nice rest. By the way, I had gone back to my first broker's, Harding Brothers, and my account had got to be pretty active. I could swing 3,000 or 4,000 shares. That wasn't much more than I had done in the old Cosmopolitan shop when I was barely 20 years of age, but there was some difference between my 1-point margin in the bucket shop and the margin required by brokers who actually bought or sold stocks for my account on the New York Stock Exchange. You may remember the story I told you about that time when I was short 3,500 sugar in the Cosmopolitan, and I had a hunch something was wrong and I'd better close the trade. Well, I've often had that curious feeling. As a rule, I yield to it. I want to tell you only about one of them because of what it did for me. It happened when I was having that little vacation in Atlantic City in the spring of 1906. I had a friend with me who was also a customer of Harding Brothers. I had no interest in the market one way or another and was enjoying my rest. I can always give up trading to play, unless, of course, it is an exceptionally active market in which my commitments are rather heavy. It was a bull market, as I remember. The outlook was favorable for general business, and the stock market had slowed down, but the tone was firm, and all indications pointed to higher prices. One morning, we had breakfasted and had finished reading all the New York morning papers. It was not noon yet, and we walked up slowly to kill time and breathe the salt air. Harding Brothers had a branch office on the boardwalk, and we used to drop in every morning and see how they'd opened. It was more force of habit than anything else, for I wasn't doing anything. The market we found was strong and active. My friend, who was quite bullish, was carrying a moderate line purchased several points lower. He began to tell me what an obviously wise thing it was to hold stocks for much higher prices. I wasn't paying enough attention to him to take the trouble to agree with him. I was looking over the quotation board, noting the changes. They were mostly advances, until I came to Union Pacific. I got a feeling that I ought to sell it. I can't tell you more. All I knew was that I wanted to sell Union Pacific, and I couldn't find out why I wanted to. I must have looked queer, for my friend, who was standing alongside of me, suddenly nudged me and asked, "Hey, what's the matter?" "I don't know," I answered. "Going to sleep?" he said. "No," I said. "I'm not going to sleep. What I'm going to do is sell that stock." I had always made money following my hunches. I walked over to a table where there were some blank order pads. My friend followed me. I wrote out an order to sell 1,000 Union Pacific at the market and handed it to the manager. He was smiling when I wrote it and when he took it. But when he read the order, he stopped smiling and looked at me. "Is this right?" he asked me, but I just looked at him and rushed it over to the operator. "What are you doing?" asked my friend. "I'm selling it," I told him.
"Selling what?"
1,000 UP.
"What did you hear?"
"I didn't hear a thing."
"Then why in blazes are you selling?"
"I don't know," I told him. I spoke gospel truth. "Oh, come across, Lair," he said. "I don't know," I repeated. "I just feel that something is going to happen."
"What's going to happen?"
"I don't know. I can't give you a reason. All I know is that I want to sell that stock, and I'm going to let them have another 1,000. I walked back into the office and gave an order to sell a 2,000. If I was right in selling the 1,000, I ought to have out a little more.
"What could possibly happen?" persisted my friend, who couldn't make up his mind to follow my lead.
"A million things could happen. But I can't promise you that any of them will. I can't give you any reasons, and I can't tell fortunes," I told him.
"Then you're crazy," he said. "Let's get out of this place before you sell the entire capital stock."
I had sold as much as I needed to satisfy my feeling, so I followed him without waiting for a report on the last 2,000 shares. It was a pretty good jag of stock for me to sell, even with the best of reasons. It seemed more than enough to be short of without any reason whatever, particularly when the entire market was so strong and there was nothing in sight to make anybody think of the bear side. But I remembered that on previous occasions, when I had the same urge to sell and didn't do it, I always had reasons to regret it. I have told some of these stories to friends, and some of them tell me it isn't a hunch, but the subconscious mind, which is the creative mind, at work. All I know is that I went out of the Atlantic City branch office of Harding Brothers, short 3,000 Union Pacific in a rising market, and I wasn't worried a bit. I have told some of these stories to friends, and some of them tell me it isn't a hunch, but the subconscious mind, which is the creative mind, at work. All I know is that I went out of the Atlantic City branch office of Harding Brothers, short 3,000 Union Pacific in a rising market, and I wasn't worried a bit. The next day, the general market went up some more, and I heard nothing but cheerful remarks from my friend. But I felt sure I had done right to sell UP. And I never get impatient when I feel I am right. What's the sense? That afternoon, Union Pacific stopped climbing, and toward the end of the day it began to go off. Pretty soon it got down to a point below the level of the average of my 3,000 shares. I felt more positive than ever that I was on the right side, and since I felt that way, I naturally had to sell some more. So toward the close, I sold an additional 2,000 shares. There I was, short 5,000 shares of UP on a hunch. That was as much as I could sell in Harding's office with the margin I had up. It was too much stock for me to be short of on a vacation. So I gave up the vacation and returned to New York that very night. There was no telling what might happen, and I thought I'd better be Johnny on the spot. There I could move quickly if I had to. The next day we got the news of the San Francisco earthquake. It was an awful disaster, but the market opened down only a couple of points. The bull forces were at work, and the public never is independently responsive to news. I was short 5,000 shares. The blow had fallen, but my stock hadn't. My hunch was of the first water, but my bank account wasn't growing, not even on paper. The friend who had been in Atlantic City with me when I put out my short line in UP was glad and sad about it. He told me, "That was some hunch, kid. But say, when the talent and the money are all on the bull side, what's the use of bucking against them? They're bound to win out." "Give them time," I said. I meant prices. I wouldn't cover because I knew the damage was enormous and the Union Pacific would be one of the worst sufferers. But it was exasperating to see the blindness of the street. "Give 'em time, and your skin will be where all the other bear hides are stretched out in the sun drying," he assured me. "What would you do?" I asked him. "Buy UP on the strength of the millions of dollars of damage suffered by the Southern Pacific and other lines? Where are the earnings for dividends going to come from after they pay for all they've lost? The best you can say is that the trouble may not be as bad as it's painted. But is that a reason for buying the stocks of the roads chiefly affected? Answer me that." But all my friend said was, "Yes, that listens fine. But I tell you, the market doesn't agree with you. The tape doesn't lie, does it?" "It doesn't always tell the truth on the instant," I said. On the following day, when fuller reports came in, the market began to slide off. But even then, not as violently as it should. Knowing that nothing under the sun could stave off a substantial break, I doubled up and sold 5,000 shares. On the day following, the market began to go for fair. There was the dickens to pay. Of course, I pushed my luck for all it was worth. I doubled up again and sold 10,000 shares more. It was the only play possible. I wasn't thinking of anything except that I was right, 100% right, and that was a heaven-sent opportunity. It was up to me to take advantage of it. I sold more. I was not betting blindly. I wasn't a crazy bear. I wasn't drunk with success or thinking that because Frisco was pretty well wiped off the map, the entire country was headed for the scrap heap. No, indeed. I didn't look for a panic. Well, the next day I cleaned up. I made $250,000. It was my biggest winnings up to that time. It was all made in a few days. The street paid no attention to the earthquake the first day or two. They'll tell you that it was because the first dispatches were not so alarming. But I think it was because it took so long to change the point of view of the public toward the securities markets. Even the professional traders, for the most part, were slow and short-sighted. I have no explanation to give you, either scientific or childish. I am telling you what I did and why and what came of it. I was much less concerned with the mystery of the hunch than with the fact that I got a quarter of a million out of it. It meant that I could now swing a much bigger line than ever, if or when the time came for it. I studied the situation in 1906, and I thought that the money outlook was particularly serious. Much actual wealth the world over had been destroyed. Everybody must sooner or later feel the pinch, and therefore nobody would be in position to help anybody. It would not be the kind of hard times that comes from the swapping of a house worth $10,000 for a carload of racehorses worth $8,000. It was the complete destruction of the house by fire, and of most of the horses by a railroad wreck. It was good, hard cash that went up in cannon smoke in the Boer War, and the millions spent for feeding non-producing soldiers in South Africa meant no help from British investors as in the past. Also, the earthquake and the fire in San Francisco and other disasters touched everybody, manufacturers, farmers, merchants, laborers, and millionaires. The railroads must suffer greatly. I figured that nothing could stave off one peach of a smash. Such being the case, there was but one thing to do: sell stocks. I had already observed that my initial transaction after I made up my mind which way I was going to trade was apt to show me a profit. And now, when I decided to sell, I plunged. Since we undoubtedly were entering upon a genuine bear market, I was sure I should make the biggest killing of my career. The market went off. Then it came back. It shaded off, and then it began to advance steadily. My paper profits vanished, and my paper losses grew. One day it looked as if not a bear would be left to tell the tale of the strictly genuine bear market. I couldn't stand the gaff. I covered. It was just as well. If I hadn't, I wouldn't have had enough left to buy a postal card. I lost most of my fur, but it was better to live to fight another day. I had made a mistake. But where? I was bearish in a bear market. That was wise. I had sold stocks short. That was proper. I had sold them too soon. That was costly. My position was right, but play was wrong. However, every day brought the market eater to the inevitable smash. So I waited, and when the rally began to falter and pause, I let them have as much stock as my sadly diminished margins permitted. I was right this time, for exactly one whole day, for on the next there was another rally, another big bite out of yours truly. So I read the tape and covered and waited. In due course I sold again, and again they went down promisingly, and then they rudely rallied. I was nearly 27 years old. I had been at the game 12 years. But the first time I traded because of a crisis that was still to come, I found that I had been using a telescope. Between my first glimpse of the storm cloud and the time for cashing in on the big break, the stretch was evidently so much greater than I had thought that I began to wonder whether I really saw what I thought I saw so clearly. We had had many warnings and sensational ascensions in call money rates. Still, some of the great financiers talked hopefully, at least to newspaper reporters, and the ensuing rallies in the stock market gave the lie to the calamity howlers. Was I fundamentally wrong in being bearish, or merely temporarily wrong in having begun to sell short too soon? I decided that I began too soon, that I really couldn't help it. Then the market began to sell off. That was my opportunity. I sold all I could. And then stocks rallied again to quite a high level. It cleaned me out. There I was, right and busted. I tell you, it was remarkable. What happened was this. I looked ahead and saw a big pile of dollars. I didn't wait to determine whether or not the time was right for plunging on the bear side. On the one occasion when I should have invoked the aid of my tape reading, I didn't do it. That is how I came to learn that even when one is properly bearish at the very beginning of a bear market, it is well not to begin selling in bulk until there is no danger of the engine backfiring. I had traded in a good many thousands of shares at Harding's office in all those years, and moreover, the firm had confidence in me and our relations were of the pleasantest. So there was no trouble about my being able to trade there again, as long as my credit stood high. The succession of spankings I had received made me less aggressively cocksure. Perhaps I should say less careless, for, of course, I knew I was just so much nearer to the smash. All I could do was wait, watchfully, as I should have done, before plunging. Well, sir, one fine morning I came downtown feeling cocksure once more. There wasn't any doubt this time. I had read an advertisement in the financial pages of all the newspapers. That was the high sign I hadn't had the sense to wait for before plunging. It was the announcement of a new issue of stock by the Northern Pacific and Great Northern Roads. The payments were to be made on the installment plan for the convenience of the stockholders. This consideration was something new in Wall Street. It struck me as more than ominous. For years, the unfailing bull item on Great Northern Preferred had been the announcement that another melon was to be cut, said melon consisting of the right of the lucky stockholders to subscribe at par to a new issue of Great Northern stock. These rights were valuable, since the market price was always way above par. But now the money market was such that the most powerful banking houses in the country were none too sure the stockholders would be able to pay cash for the bargain, and Great Northern Preferred was selling at about $3.30. As soon as I got to the office, I told Ed Harding, "The time to sell is right now. This is when I should have begun. Just look at that ad, will you?" He had seen it. I pointed out what the banker's confession amounted to, in my opinion. But he couldn't quite see the big break right on top of us. He thought it better to wait before putting out a very big short line by reason of the market's habit of having big rallies. If I waited, prices might be lower, but the operation would be safer. That ad is a signed confession on the part of the bankers. What they fear is what I hope. This is a sign for us to get aboard the bear wagon. It's all we needed. If I had $10 million, I'd stake every cent of it this minute. I had to do some more talking and arguing. He wasn't content with the only inferences a sane man could draw from that amazing advertisement. It was enough for me, but not for most of the people in the office. I sold a little. Too little. A few days later, St. Paul very kindly came out with an announcement of an issue of its own, either stock or notes, I forget which, but that doesn't matter. What mattered then was that I noticed the moment I read it that the date of payment was set ahead of the Great Northern and Northern Pacific payments, which had been announced earlier. It was as plain as though they had used a megaphone that grand old St. Paul was trying to beat the two other railroads to what little money there was floating around in Wall Street. St. Paul's bankers quite obviously feared that there wasn't enough for all three, and they were not saying, "After you, my dear Alphonse." If money already was that scarce, and you bet the bankers knew, what would it be later? The railroads needed it desperately. It wasn't there. What was the answer? Sell 'em, of course. The public, with their eyes fixed on the stock market, saw little that week. The wise stock operators saw much that year. That was the difference. For me, that was the end of doubt and hesitation. I made up my mind for keeps then and there. That same morning, I began what really was my first campaign along the lines that I have since followed. I told Harding what I thought and how I stood, and he made no objections to my selling Great Northern Preferred at around 3:30 and other stocks at high prices. I profited by my earlier and costly mistakes and sold more intelligently. My reputation and my credit were reestablished in a jiffy. I had a wonderful time after that, and in February of 1907 I cleaned up. I had been right, I had looked ahead, and followed a clear-cut plan. I had learned what a man must do in order to make big money. I was permanently out of the gambler class. I had at last learned to trade intelligently in a big way. The recognition of our mistakes should not benefit us any more than the study of our successes. But there is a natural tendency in all men to avoid punishment. When you associate certain mistakes with a licking, you do not hanker for a second dose. And, of course, all stock market mistakes wound you in two tender spots, your pocketbook and your vanity. Of course, if a man is both wise and lucky, he will not make the same mistake twice. To tell you about the first of my million-dollar mistakes, I shall have to go back to this time when I first became a millionaire, in October 1907. As far as my trading went, having a million merely meant more reserves. Money does not give a trader more comfort, because rich or poor, he can make mistakes, and it is never comfortable to be wrong. And when a millionaire is right, his money is merely one of his several servants. Losing money is the least of my troubles. A loss never bothers me after I take it. I forget it overnight. But being wrong, not taking the loss, that is what does the damage to the pocketbook and to the soul. As a rule, a man adapts himself to conditions so quickly that he loses the perspective. I mean that after a man makes money in the stock market, he very quickly loses the habit of not spending. But after he loses his money, it takes him a long time to lose the habit of spending. After I took in my shorts and went long in October of 1907, I decided to take it easy for a while. I bought a yacht and planned to go off on a cruise in southern waters. I am crazy about fishing, and I was due to have the time of my life. I looked forward to it and expected to go any day. But I did not. The market wouldn't let me. I always have traded in commodities as well as in stocks. I began as a youngster in the bucket shops. I studied those markets for years, though perhaps not so assiduously as the stock market. As a matter of fact, I would rather play commodities than stocks. There is no question about their greater legitimacy, as it were. Dividends are not unexpectedly passed or increased overnight in the cotton market, or in wheat or corn. In the long run, commodity prices are governed but by one law, the economic law of demand and supply. The business of the trader in commodities is simply to get facts about the demand and the supply, present and prospective. He does not indulge in guesses about a dozen things as he does in stocks. It always appealed to me. Trading in commodities. When a man makes his play in a commodity market, he does not permit himself set opinions. He must have an open mind and flexibility. It is not wise to disregard the message of the tape, no matter what your opinion of crop conditions or of the probable demand may be. I recall how I missed a big play just by trying to anticipate the starting signal. I felt so sure of conditions that I thought it was not necessary to wait for the line of least resistance to define itself. I even thought I might help it arrive, because it looked as if it merely needed a little assistance. I was very bullish on cotton. It was hanging around 12 cents, running up and down within a moderate range. It was in one of those in-between places, and I could see it. I knew I really ought to wait, but I got to thinking that if I gave it a little push, it would go beyond the upper resistance point. I bought 50,000 bales. Sure enough, it moved up, and sure enough, as soon as I stopped buying it, it stopped going up. Then it began to settle back to where it was when I began buying it. I got out, and it stopped going down. I thought I was now much nearer the starting signal, and presently I thought I'd start it myself again. I did. The same thing happened. I bid it up, only to see it go down when I stopped. I did this four or five times until I finally quit in disgust. It cost me about $200,000. I was done with it. It wasn't very long after that, when it began to go up and never stopped till it got to a price that would have meant a killing for me, if I hadn't been in such a great hurry to start. This experience has been the experience of so many traders so many times that I can give this rule. In a narrow market, when prices are not getting anywhere to speak of, but move within a narrow range, there is no sense in trying to anticipate what the next big movement is going to be, up or down. The thing to do is to watch the market, read the tape to determine the limits of the get-nowhere prices, and make up your mind that you will not take an interest until the price breaks through the limit in either direction. A speculator must concern himself with making money out of the market, and not with insisting that the tape must agree with him. Never argue with it, or ask it for reasons or explanations. Stock market postmortems don't pay dividends. In cotton, I was very successful in my trading for a long time. I had my theory about it, and I absolutely lived up to it. Suppose I had decided that my line would be 40 to 50,000 bales. Well, I would study the tape, as I told you, watching for an opportunity either to buy or to sell. Suppose the line of least resistance indicated a bull movement. Well, I would buy 10,000 bales. After I got through buying that, if the market went up 10 points over my initial purchase price, I would take on another 10,000 bales. Same thing. Then, if I could get 20 points profit, or $1 a bale, I would buy 20,000 more. That would give me my line, my basis for my trading. But if, after buying the first 10 or 20,000 bales, it showed me a loss, out I'd go. I was wrong. It might be I was only temporarily wrong. But, as I have said before, it doesn't pay to start wrong in anything. What I accomplished by sticking to my system was that I always had a line of cotton in every real movement. In the course of accumulating my full line, I might chip out $50,000 or $60,000 in these feeling-out plays of mine. This looks like a very expensive testing, but it wasn't. After the real movement started, how long would it take me to make up the $50,000 I had dropped in order to make sure that I began to load up at exactly the right time? No time at all. It always pays a man to be right at the right time. As I think I also said before, this describes what I may call my system for placing my bets. It is simple arithmetic to prove that it is a wise thing to have the big bet down only when you win, and when you lose, to lose only a small exploratory bet, as it were. If a man trades the way I have described, he will always buy in the profitable position of being able to cash in on the big bet. Professional traders have always had some system or other based upon their experience and governed either by their attitude toward speculation or by their desires. I sometimes think that speculation must be an unnatural sort of business because I find that the average speculator has arrayed against him his own nature. The weaknesses that all men are prone to are fatal to success in speculation. Usually those very weaknesses that make him likable to his fellows or that he himself particularly guards against in those other ventures of his where they are not nearly so dangerous as when he is trading in stocks or commodities. The speculator's chief enemies are always boring from within. It is inseparable from human nature to hope and to fear. In speculation, when the market goes against you, you hope that every day will be the last day, and you lose more than you should had you not listened to hope, to the same ally that is so potent a success bringer to empire builders and pioneers big and little. And when the market goes your way, you become fearful that the next day will take away your profit, and you get out too soon. Fear keeps you from making as much money as you ought to. The successful trader has to fight these two deep-seated instincts. He has to reverse what you might call his natural impulses. Instead of hoping, he must fear. Instead of fearing, he must hope. He must fear that his loss may develop into a much bigger loss and hope that his profit may become a big profit. It is absolutely wrong to gamble in stocks the way the average man does. I have been in the speculative game ever since I was 14. It is all I have ever done. I think I know what I'm talking about. And the conclusion that I have reached after nearly 30 years of constant trading, both on a shoestring and with millions of dollars back of me, is this. A man may beat a stock or a group at a certain time, but no man living can beat the stock market. A man may make money out of individual deals in cotton or grain, but no man can beat the cotton market or the grain market. It's like the track. A man may beat a horse race, but he cannot beat horse racing. If I knew how to make these statements stronger or more emphatic, I certainly would. It does not make any difference what anybody says to the contrary. I know I am right in saying these are incontrovertible statements. And now I'll get back to October 1907. I bought a yacht and left New York for a cruise in southern waters.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.